nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay. Thank you very much for showing up in the last day. And today we'll be talking about the percolation in electronic devices. So in last 2 weeks, we have heard about quantum transport from Professor Supriya Datta and about ballistic transport from Professor Lundstrom. And they explained beautifully the issues, both the broad picture and as well as the subtle issues associated with these points of views and why they are important for modern devices. Now, you think that you don't have to really learn anything more, but unfortunately or fortunately, there is a third thing that people are interested in when devices become very small, and that has to do with percolation, and it's becoming increasingly important, more important, as devices become small and as electronics broadens out of small MOSFETs to a large range of other class of devices. So we'll see how it goes. So the plan for the lecture series is that I plan to have 5 lectures. It may end up being 5.5 because there is some extra material I want to record a little bit later. But I'll start by talking about that. Why do you need percolation in electronic devices to begin with? I mean, if you are a student in electrical engineering or even in physics, generally you could get your PhD degree without even having to know about percolation at all. I mean, only time you may have heard about percolation is the coffee percolator, to wake up in the morning. But other than that, well, we generally don't talk about percolative transport. So I'd like to convince you today in the first lecture that why it's a fundamentally important thing and why you couldn't simply do some computer simulation in order to get a feel for it. It's much deeper than that, more fundamental. Okay, so once, if I could convince you that this is something worthwhile to do, then I'd like to explain 3 basic concepts. The first concept will be threshold, percolation threshold, and I'll explain something happens below the threshold. You know, that's what the word threshold means. If something happens below that, something happens after that. And that dividing line is very important. I'll try to explain that. I'll talk about island sizes. Now, these are not classical islands, of course, you understand. And then finally about fractal dimensions. Now, these you may have heard from popular literature or popular books, but I'd like to explain the salient features of it, because in the next 3 lectures, the 3rd, 4th, and the 5th, what I'd like to do is take these 3 concepts of percolation threshold, island sizes, and fractal dimensions to solve 3 classes of problems. And these 3 classes of problems, you will see that it addresses a wide range of issues. So the 3 lectures that you will see, essentially the first one was in electrical conduction in random media. And I'll show that how Ohm's law, you know, in last 2 weeks we are trying to interpret the meaning of a resistance when devices get small, and how Ohm's law fails when devices become very short or very small. I'd like to generalize on that how nonlinear conduction is an essential aspect of random media and how we eventually get Ohm's law out of it. The 4th lecture will be on stick percolation. Now, this you will see a wide range of applications. I will showing concretely that how without percolation, you couldn't even think about these classes of devices. And these are very important and interesting class of device that we will work with. And finally, about 2-dimensional networks in 3-dimensional world. It sounds interesting, hopefully. And I'll show how it's relevant for sensors, solar cells, you know, for energy conversion and supercapacitors. So hopefully, if we understand this thing, the payoff is significant, that we'll be able to handle a broader class of devices than we can currently think of based on our standard textbooks. Now, I'm very fortunate to work with a very good group of students, and they are here, Danub Varghese, Pradeep Nair, and Ehtisham Islam. They have really helped me to put together a lot of things. So I want to start by acknowledging how wonderful their efforts have been, and you'll see many of their results of their effort in my talk. So the first thing I want to point out in lecture one is that although in semiconductor courses you might have a feeling that regular crystal is the norm, that when we learn about semiconductor devices, all the atoms, we make this assumption that all the atoms are in their respective positions, nicely ordered and regimented. We know about chronic penny model, band structure and all. That's one end. In the other end, we learn about hydrogen atoms. All, you take one hydrogen atom here, another hydrogen atom somewhere else, they are all the same. And so, therefore, you learn about this identical properties, either of a periodic layer structure or of isolated atoms. But in reality, of course, this is not the norm. This is really the exception. And what I'd like to start with is by explaining that how randomness in electronics is actually pervasive. This is, you see it all the time, but you ignore it because we don't know exactly how to handle this. The next topic is that, if it is so important, why do we neglect it or why do we not hear about it? Well, the first thing is that many times systems historically used to be so big that average properties mattered. The fluctuation itself didn't really matter that much. And many times in physics, what we do is focus on, even when smaller structures, focus on those special cases where we see the fluctuation sort of disappearing. Those are the features because we can analyze them beautifully. So we focus on them. But in some way, that is a subset of a much larger class of problems. And we need percolation theory sort of to handle those type of problems. And I'll try to show you by two examples that if you do not do this correctly, it is possible to get very wrong answers, not qualitatively, quantitatively wrong answers. And these have deep technological implications. So these are important problems, not just theoretical construct. And I'll conclude. Now, as you know, transistor was invented about 50, 60 years ago. And these days you have is this big semiconductor industry. In one end, you have microprocessors. We want to make them as small as possible. Smaller, the better. And we want the performance to be as high as possible. And these days, you might have an integrated circuit that may have a billion transistors, let's say 50 nanometer in each transistor. In the last 2 weeks, you have heard about them a lot. Now, of course, when things get small, then we have discussed that how the notion of an effective mass doesn't make sense anymore because you have levels or density of state. And you couple into the state using gamma 1 and gamma 2, and thereby you can calculate the transport properties. You don't really have to worry about effective mass anymore if the device is small. Now, Professor Lundstrom also told you about that what happens if you do not have scattering, going from one contact to the other, if you don't have any scattering, which means the tau going to infinity. Tau is the mean time between scattering. And if you don't have any scattering, then tau could be infinity, let's say. So in that case, how do you reformulate the problem so still you get the correct answer? And hopefully by now, you're expert in it. You know how to calculate those. But when things get small, not only the scattering goes down, not only the effective mass doesn't make any sense, but at the same time, fluctuation becomes very important. For example, I give you three examples and we'll discuss it more. For example, these days, you know, oxides are only a few atoms thick. 1 nanometer or 1.2 nanometer, 5-6 atom thick. And how they break, some will break early, some will break later, that depends on, that is very critically dependent on the fact that this is a very small system. So if you have five defects in one oxide versus five defects in another oxide, then they might actually behave very differently. So average doesn't matter. And I'll explain that a little bit more. The second example is about random defects. As electrons are going from source to drain, then these black points you see are, let's say, the dopant atoms and are the scatterers. And as the electrons are going from source to drain, you can see from here that they will take various contours. Now, the problem is that even if you had two structures which are exactly the same, same number of atoms, but if their configuration is different, then the flow of current will be different. And if the flow of the current is different, then the resistance is different. So therefore, this average formula for G, that wouldn't really make much sense. And the third one is about nanocrystal flash. I will talk a little bit more about that and a little bit later. But that's just on the microprocessor side, when things become small. But there is this huge other part of electronics that we generally don't talk about, and that has to do with thin film transistors, that is the TFT, based on amorphous silicon or polysilicon transistors, flexible electronics based on organics. There are solar cells, you know, big energy crisis, and supercapacitors for charge storage. In all those cases, fluctuation is the norm, because in many cases, what we'll see that not only fluctuation is important as a consequence of the technology, but many times we introduce this randomness in order to enhance the performance of the device. That sounds counterintuitive, right? Why would you really make things random to improve things? And I'll show you how that occurs. And very intuitively, this follows. And for energy storage, again, I'll show you examples. But the bottom line is that in all these cases, the unifying feature is what we used to call this length L, from current flowing from one end to another, channel length, for example. When device becomes very small, that length doesn't mean what it used to. So that's something I'd like to talk about today. So let me, you know, one thing is to sort of say it in vaguely, just as I just said. I want to emphasize the point a little bit more, that exactly what are we asking about and what are should we be studying. So the first problem is random dopant fluctuation. This is a MOSFET, and the light magenta region, you can see here, this is the oxide and the source and the drain. And I have drawn a few dopants in deep blue. And if you have a 100 nanometer depletion region, let's say, and a 100 nanometer by 100 nanometer channel, then at 10 to the power 18, you have about 1,000 dopants. If the channel length is 20 nanometer, well, in that case, maybe 40 dopants. By the time you have 10 nanometer, you have 10 dopants. Now, 10 dopants means some transistor will have 8. Some might have 13. Well, some might even have 2, because you have a billion of them. And so, when you are talking about doping, you're saying that I doped my transistor at 10 to the 18. And I have a certain threshold voltage. Well, you cannot talk about that anymore in very small devices. So what are you going to do about this? And of course, as I mentioned, the current flow, the contour of the current flow will be deeply curved depending on the configuration of these dopants. And the model that we'll be using, and I want to show you why this model is very relevant, often and often is this model about a checkerboard on which we put disks. And this disk could be, for example, in this case, the checkerboard could be conducting, and the disk could be insulating or scattering centers. And we'd like to ask the general question that what is the property of current flow through a structure like this? When you put insulating disk around or scattering centers around, how do you think about current? And it looks like it's impossible to think about current in such a random structure. And maybe you'll have to compute it every time you create a configuration, put it in a computer, calculate a current. But, you know, if you have to do it for a billion transistor, you'll be in trouble. So we'll have to do something better. That's random dopant fluctuation. You know, and that, of course, in all logic transistors and SRAM cells, that's the same problem you'll have everywhere. Then there are these problems of memory. You know, if the flash memory that you carry in your pocket many times is for storing songs, let's say, in iPod and other cases, is based on, say, a memory concept called a flash memory. And what happens in a flash memory, it's almost like a regular MOSFET, except you have in the deep blue a region of silicon in between two oxide regions, this in light magenta. And when you put a lot of charge in the blue region, then you can see the threshold voltage will be very large and the current flow from the source to drain will be small. If you don't have any charge, and we'll call that logic state one. If you don't have any charge, then in that case, you see threshold voltage will be low, there'll be a lot of current flow, so that will be state zero. Now, what happens all the time, and it's a major problem in technology today, is many times the oxide is so thin that you will have a defect. What that defect does is that, let's say you have stored a one there, what this defect does is essentially takes the charge and drains it out. It's like you have a balloon, you put a needle in it, and through the needle comes out all the gas. Now, if you had a one there, that was your song or whatever it was, or a PowerPoint slide if you are technically inclined. So in that case, but your ones will now become a zero. And of course, the whole data will be corrupted and you'll be very unhappy. In order to avoid this, and this is a fundamental problem in technology today, because the devices are getting so small, the amount of charge you have is very small, so therefore, people have a lot of trouble in this type of devices. So what people generally do is to, instead of putting all your eggs in one basket, you divide your eggs in multiple baskets. And that is what this nanocrystal flash is all about. That you have here, in this little circles, these are silicon nanocrystals. And since they are divided, you can see that if you have a defect, it will only drain the local charge island. It will not drain everything, so which will be good. Then we can retain the charge. But of course, you realize that from a top view, that if the defect happens where the island is small, then it will drain a little bit of charge. But if it happens to hit a place where the island is big, then it can drain a huge amount of charge. And so here you can see, here we are not asking the question that how does current flow from source to drain? But rather we are asking the question that what is the size of the islands? Because that will help us to understand that if I hit one point randomly, how much charge will be discharged through this? And again, you can see, you can again take that model, but this time, you will be asking not the question about current flow through the structure, but you will be asking the question of island size distribution. Another example. So this is again from display. I talked about microprocessors and memories. For example, in displays, as you know, in solar cells or the flat panel displays, we talk about current flow from source to drain, but these transistors are not single crystalline transistors. These are polysilicon transistors. And the reason is because polysilicon is, you can grow it at lower temperature, the cost is lower, and also you want to put it on glass. And the glass, if you raise the temperature too much in order to deposit single crystalline silicon, that will melt. So therefore, you have to do it at low temperature. And what happens as a result, you cannot have, do not have a single crystal everywhere, a crystal of multiple sizes. That's what you have here. And the question you want to ask again is, how does current flow from source to drain given this random gain structure? And this is a question you have to answer, because otherwise, if the current in each pixel is different, then of course brightness of your display at every point will be different and you will not be very happy. You will take it back to whichever manufacturer made it. Another example is, that's very important, also getting very important, is about this flexible electronics that is on plastic. Plastic electronics on plastic. Again, in this case, this is a paper that came out yesterday, and this is done by a technology called a nanonet technology, which is where instead of the source and drain being connected by a continuous single crystalline silicon, for example. It is connected from source to drain by a set of sticks. And these are could be carbon nanotube or silicon nanowire. And so these are a bunch of sticks. And this essentially, electrons will hop from one stick to the next, and then thereby it will go from source to drain. Now, in this case, if you wanted to model this, how would you do that? Can you take the previous models that I talked about, for example, for nanocrystal flash or random dopant? Can you do that? Not really, because, you know, that sticks don't look like a circle to me. So if I tried to do, so I made a huge study, I read a deep percolation book. After 2 years, I come down and try to solve this problem, I'll be totally lost. Because these are sticks. Sticks have very different properties than circles. And what you have to do is actually learn about stick percolation. And what I'd like to show that if you know about disk percolation, stick percolation doing it is actually very easy. And that's what I'd like to show you. But it's in a very deep way different also. So I'd like to explain that in the second lecture. Now, first of all, this is not something a physicist would typically do. Physicists will look at properties of disk percolation and study it, you know, in 1D, 2D, 3D, 5D, 7D, because then the mathematics becomes so beautiful that you actually end up thinking about mathematics and the exponents more than actually devices, but which is fine for it depends on the particular problem that you are interested in. But for electrical engineers, it's a little bit even more interesting and difficult. Because as you know, that carbon nanotubes have 1/3 metallic and 2/3 semiconducting nanotubes. You may have heard about it, but if you haven't, just accept it, that 1/3 metallic and 2/3 semiconducting. That means I not only have to think about stick percolation, I will have to think about stick percolation in which there are two components. One is metallic and another is semiconducting. So there is this so-called heterogeneous percolation. Now, if you Google on it, you'll actually find nothing, because this is a topic that people haven't really touched about. And still, in the third lecture, you will see, in the fourth lecture, you will see that how understanding this heterogeneous percolation allows you to explore a whole set of issues that you wouldn't have touched otherwise. Now, another aspect is solar cells, and this is really in preparation for the fifth lecture. Now, you know solar cells, as Professor Datta has mentioned last week, that you can anytime use a PN junction, for example, for solar cells. So here, for example, on the top, you have a transparent electrode so that light can come through. And in the bottom, you have another electrode. This could be a PN junction. And if you generate electron hole pairs, then they can be separated in the junction. And the current can come out and you can light a light bulb. Let's say you can do that. Now, this is really not very good. The efficiency is very good. Physics is all fine. But the reason this is not very good is because it's very expensive. The amount of energy that you spend to make this single crystalline silicon solar cells, you will take several years, some say 10 years, to even recoup the cost of energy that you put into it. And then you can start thinking about green energy after that. So this is a big problem. So what people are doing instead is they are making solar cells based on organic materials, because those you can process at room temperature. Energy expenditure isn't that bad. But there are problems. So for example, what happens that, let's say light comes in and it generates an electron hole pair. Now in organic materials, these are like polymer chains, one-dimensional chains, just like carbon nanotube, just flexible. And here what happens that when you generate an electron hole pair, the Coulomb interaction is still so strong that they don't get dissociated. They stay together and start diffusing together, and that's called an exciton. It has a little bit less energy than free particles, but they keep diffusing, and this happens in all organic materials, a very important process. Then what happens, that it reaches the junction, and when it reaches the junction, the strong electric field pulls them out. So electron goes one way, and the hole goes another way. But you can see that electrons holes are staying very close, dangerously close together. So before they reach the junction, they may recombine. And if they recombine, you have nothing. You don't have any electron hole. You have no external current. So that's a big problem. And by the way, just to explain that same process, how it works in band diagram, that this is an exciton, the red and the white together. And remember, this is chargeless because electron has negative charge, holes have positive charge. And when they move together, they don't have any charge. So they just diffuse around. And only when you have an electric field that varies faster than the dimension of the exciton, then otherwise it cannot pull it apart. And so in the junction then, electron goes on one way and the hole goes the other way. So what do I do about it? You know, this is cheap, but also very bad or very poor efficiency. So I didn't really gain anything. So what do I do about it? And this is where randomness actually improves performance. And that's why we have to understand it from that context. So what people do in this case is that instead of keeping these two materials separate, they will actually intermix them, deeply intermix them, and that's the nanostructured structure. What will happen if you intermix them? Well, what happens is that when the two structures are so integrally mixed, you know, I couldn't draw it very well, then, of course, any point you generate an exciton, there will be a closed by surface to take away the electron and hole pairs. And as a result, because of this deep nanostructuring of the materials, of the two materials, of the two PN junctions, you can have a higher efficiency because things will not recombine before they have a chance to dissociate. So this is something in almost every university in this country and most labs, this is how they make solar cells, organic solar cells. Now the question is, how would you handle such a system? Again, percolation comes to the rescue. If you understand this problem of a material which is intermixed, and then ask the question that if I have an electron hole generation, then how they get dissociated? And after dissociation, if you are on a branch, on a corner, sitting on a corner, let's say like at this red point, sitting on a corner and trying to get out through of the contacts, then you'll have to take a very complicated path. The junction depth doesn't really mean anything. Length doesn't mean anything. So in that case, how do you solve this problem? And that is what we'd like to answer in lecture 5, because this turns out to be just a reasonably simple question, and that has very elegant answers. Finally, energy generation is not enough, because if you put solar cells on your car, try to drive it at night, you'll not go very far. And maybe on a windy day, on a cloudy day, you'll have to park your car in the garage as well. So that's not very good. So energy storage is very important. And again, here, nanostructuring plays a fundamental role. For example, for a normal capacitor, you know, the capacitance is given by the dielectric constant epsilon, area, and divided by the separation D of the plates. Now, of course, you want to make D as small as possible. And one way of making D as small as possible, but without the two plates shorting out, is to do this, what they call this electrolyte capacitor. You know, sometimes you buy them. And the idea is that when you apply a positive bias, if you have an electrolyte, liquid electrolyte, in the material, in the inside, then if you have a positive bias, the negative charges of the electrolyte will get a little closer. And the positive charges will be pushed out a little bit. And so the net moment of the charge will be separated by a certain distance. Let's call that D. And you can see this will be conformal because the shape can be anything of the top electrode, but the D will follow it. And as a result, it will never short it out. And so therefore, you can increase capacitance this way. So that's why electrolyte capacitors are good. But what people do is something even more esoteric. That instead of making that plate parallel, you can take materials in which, like activated charcoal or porous alumina, in which the structure is so deeply corrugated that the surface area might go up by several orders of magnitude. this is a number you should remember, that in 1 gram, 1 gram of activated charcoal, the effective area is 500 meters squared. 1 gram, 500 meters squared. So therefore, these supercapacitors can have effective area so much larger that while for a parallel plate capacitor, a microfarad is a good number, you know, typical number, for the same area, same volume, you can have tens of farads of supercapacitance in this structure. The question is, how would you handle such a structure? How would you handle charging and discharging time through such a structure? Again, hopefully in lecture 5, I'd like to address some of these questions, because you can see these are fundamentally all the same questions. These are from different areas, but if you understand the physics of how things work, then it will not be too bad. By the way, you shouldn't think these are science fictions. These are things that are routinely used in many, many cases. Another example is from biosensors, and here we have a XY grid of sensors. It's a two-dimensional array, and each point, each sensor here in the intersection point, you can have a silicon transistor, for example, and in the silicon transistor is generally decorated with a known strand of DNA. Let's say biosensing example. And what happens that, let's say you bring in your unknown DNA. You bring in the unknown DNA. And DNA has a property that it conjugates only when the other side is a perfect match. Only then it conjugates. Now, this DNA carries a charge on its backbone. So when you have one DNA, you have a certain amount of current flow. It's like a gate charge. When you have two strands, you have a little bit more. And as a result, the current will be modulated. And so, wherever there is conjugation, wherever pixels you have conjugation, you knew what the original DNA strand you put there, right? And therefore, it's like fingerprint matching. And so, therefore, you will know what unknown DNA you have in your sample. And from this response, you can calculate a 95. I don't want to go into the details of this technology per se, but I only want to point out that problem is also a problem in which there is this problem of diffusion to a nanostructured surface is of fundamental importance. Because you see, the sensor is actually sitting there, and then the DNAs are floating around. It takes a certain amount of time before they find it. And the question is, how long do you have to wait before your test result from the doctor comes back? And that, in order to answer that question, you would need percolation. And final topic is something called on chemical sensing and electronic nose. You know, biosensing is very specific, that it's a conjugation. It's like a digital sensing. You either have conjugation or you do not. One or zero. And that's very important because our DNA and our genetic information would be in trouble if it's not, were not so specific. But when our nose, we try to detect odor in our nose, we don't need to be that specific. So analog sensing works. So if you have two sensors, it need not be one or zero. It could be 0.9 and 1, 0.2 and 0.8. So you can have a gradation of two sensors. Using two sensors, you may be able to identify a lot of different odors. You can read about it, just Google it. But the main point I want to make here in the context of percolation is this. The way this particular technology works, if you were to read it, you may not understand it directly, but it is based on the principles of percolation. It's not said in so many words, but it is exactly that. Assume the blue is the organic substrate, and the discs are the metallic discs, which connects the source to drain. In the absence of the odor, then you have a current flow from the source to drain. It's above percolation. So, of course, you have a current flow through the source to drain. And you can see my ammeter is reading a lot of current because there is a percolating path from source to drain. Now, what happens when the odor comes in? It goes to the organic substrate and it gets absorbed. And when you have absorption, then it expands. And when you have expansion, then you see the percolation path is broken. And when you have the percolation path broken, of course, your current goes down. That is how you recognize an unknown order, because the absorption rate depends on the substrate and the specific molecule that you are interested in. So broadly speaking then, it's like to say that as you can see that randomness is actually everywhere. You saw all this, I'm sure, many, many times, but maybe you haven't really thought about this in this particular context, maybe. So there are three problems then. The first problem is cluster sizes, problems involving cluster sizes. And I mentioned a case about nanocrystal flash, for example. And this is analogous to the problem of finding oil, which is very important these days, finding oil in an oil field. Because you want to drill at a place which have access, which is the largest pool of oil in. You don't want to drill where there's a little pool of oil, because then you'll lose money in your business. And then there is the second class of problems where you are interested in not the size, but the flow through the structure. And that, I said, is a nanonet or random dopant fluctuation, that type of issues. And similar things when people think about traffic flow through World Wide Web. The problems are very similar in terms of the mathematical structure behind it. So you can take a lot of physics from there and actually apply to this semiconductor device problem. And you will get very good results. And the third problem is out-of-plane transport. You know, one is you're flowing through the stick network or flowing through the disk network. Another is that you are flowing towards the network. And that is the third class of problems. And again, this has many natural analogs. Like when people want to design aerosol products for catching particles of multiple sizes. Again, you want to look at the structure of the net so that you can catch particles. And similarly, so you're looking out of plane, and that is the property you are interested in. So the third, fourth, and fifth lecture, we are essentially going to talk about these three things, how to handle these three class of problems. Now, the reason we didn't really hear about this is in part because generally we are interested in or traditionally interested in very large systems. Even a drop of water may have 10 to the power 17 number of molecules. So when you have such a big system, if you want to look at the transmission of light, well, if you have a little bit of trace of impurity, then you would say that the transmission gradually goes down as a function of impurity. Classical theory. But generally, this is not generally correct. If you really did percolation theory, which I'll explain later, you will get a different thing. That even when it's about 50% full, transmission may be going to zero because it's already light cannot pass through. But most of the time, we are interested in small impurity limit. So on either end, either in small impurity limit or a lot of impurity limit, you are approximately correct. And so you don't really worry about it too much. And the second is that many times we are interested in physical problems in which something special happens. For example, this is a quantum Hall effect problem. Here, of course, you could say the randomness should be important. However, you know that if you apply a strong magnetic field, as Professor Datta very elegantly explained, that the density of state essentially goes to the two sides, and there is flow on one side and flow going one way and the electron flowing on the other side, on the other way. And essentially, they don't talk to each other. No scattering. Things accurate to one part in 10 to the 7. And so in those cases, generally, we have a lot of interest because this actually gives you very high degree of precision. But you see that this is really exception. These are not the rule. Because when you have small systems, as I showed, that in small systems, actually fluctuation is a key part. It cannot really avoid it. But it is key in a very fundamental way. You see, that's the second point I want to make about biomimetic materials. When you have a DNA in a cell, if you spread it out, it will be about a meter long, or maybe 3 or 4 meter long. Diameter, 1 nanometer. Now, people talk about carbon nanotubes, 1 micron versus 1 nanometer diameter, well, aspect ratio of 1,000. Fantastic. But think about the aspect ratio of a DNA, 1 nanometer and several meters, 10 to the power 7. Still, you don't, if it were spread out like a line, then the enzymes will never find them in a reasonable amount of time where they need to go. But because they are folded, each part of the surface within a few micron, each part of the surface is readily accessible. And as a result, even these enzyme processes are so deeply effective. And after a protein has been produced in the process, the way it finds it out of the cell, there are only few cell doors, cell openings. That is also remarkably efficient. And in many ways, you can see the excitonic cell by corrugating the surface and putting it in a small volume and making the surface available for the dissociation and subsequent collection of the electrons to the contact through the corrugated structure has remarkable, deeply remarkable similarities. And that's why these materials, the reason it improves the performance is not accidental. This is how actually nature works. And as a result, it needs to be understood not as an afterthought, but as a fundamental problem on its own. So what I want to show, okay, hopefully you are convinced that it's something you might want to learn. And the top-down view where you take a few dopants and try to homogenize it and, you know, put it in a simulator, that's not a very good idea. So you may want to do, let's say, take a few dopants and do 100 simulation of the random configuration. Let's say you do that. What I want to say very importantly in this first lecture, that will not do. That's what many people do, or some people do. That's not the way to go. And percolation theory says that you cannot do this. Because although by doing this type of computer percolation as versus analytical percolation, although you could get the averages about right, which is the blue line, compared to the red line, but your standard deviation will be all wrong. And this is something I want to show. So just to very quickly, that if you had a top-down view, then generally you take these dopants and you'll homogenize them and try to flow, make an average current flow through the structure. Let's say you have a grid of 10 by 10, 30% full in one case. When you homogenize this, well, conductance has gone up by a factor 30%, let's say. Initially it was zero. If you put 50%, well, it goes up by 50%. And then if it's 80%, then you have a linear transport. This is Ohm's law. This is what we learn in textbooks. But you can see that that's not correct. Because when you have 30%, there's no way electron could go from one end to another because there's no continuous path. So current is actually zero. Now, if you make it 50%, well, still there is no path from one end to another, so current is still zero. Now, if you make it 80%, then you can see there is a path, and then you will have a current flow. So this, from the very beginning, Ohm's law will not work in such a system. And the reason is very fundamental, because here, every disk is not the same. When you add a disk at low density, well, you go a little bit up, let's say. But when you are near the percolation threshold, one trap, it's like a straw in the camel's back, the last straw. So every straw are not the same. So the last disk that you add, that may fundamentally change, all of a sudden cause a transition in the transport properties. And that's why this correlation part of it, that makes percolation so very different from the cases where we normally average over the configurations. But what about fluctuation? You see, even if you take three samples that has same 80% fill-up, and therefore you have 1 point on the average transport, The problem is that, of course, all three don't have the same connected path. So what will happen that you will have a distribution. This is the average. You will have a distribution about the mean, and there will be a corresponding deviation. And this deviation, as I'm trying to mention, that has to be done right. So the way people currently do this, and let me show you a little bit of that, that if you do it just by doing what many people will do by device simulator, continuous doping, homogenizing, you will be obviously be wrong. Okay, that's one. But even if you did it correctly by putting dopants in, buying a big computer, and you know, you do 1,000 simulation by putting the dopants in various configurations, then you will get the blue thing right, because now the percolation and other piece will come out right. But what will be wrong, and you will get various types of currents for each configuration. But if you plot it, those distribution of current, and fit it with a Gaussian, that Gaussian fit is wrong. And that's what I'd like to show you. Because that's really the central part of the problem. What I'm trying to show, percolation is important, but it has also been done in a right way. Otherwise, the results will not be appropriate. And I can assure you, Gauss wouldn't have approved this way of fitting things. And I'll explain why. But this is Gaussian fitting like this is not just in electronics. Even in other very good papers, this is a problem associated with the voltage. This is Professor Dutta explained. This is the voltage generated in response to a temperature difference. And you can see if you have 20 degrees, 10 degrees, or 30 degrees, of course, you can explain the mean by explaining the physics from a bottom-up perspective. But the question is that this deviation, you wouldn't probably be able to explain. And this deviation is very important, because if some devices generate zero voltage, and if you have a million of them, and if some of them are in series and some of them in parallel, things might not really work very well. So not only the average is important, but so is the standard deviation. So let me explain then two problems in which this sort of is clear. This comes out clearly, that why you have to do things in a different way and why the standard deviation is very important. And the bottom line of next 4 or 5 lecture is this following statement, is that distribution is physical. It is not, everything is not Gaussian. Every physical problem, physics dictates the distribution. Eventually, of course, everything can be approximated as Gaussian, but that's a limit that should not be taken lightly. Okay, so let's talk about this oxide breakdown problem. So we have a oxide and the defects are generating. You see, I animated this even. And if you look at the gate current, what you'll see, there's a strange thing, that the gate current is sort of remain independent of time as the defects are being generated. Now, immediately, that's something wrong, right? Wrong in the sense that in general theory, you would say, well, I have defects, so I should linearly interpolate as a function of defect density and the current should go up linearly. But you can see in experiment, the current is flat. Then, all of a sudden, let's say a defect path, a certain number of boxes, red boxes, they line up. And then you have a short from source to from the substrate to the gate. And all of a sudden, you have a jump in the current. And if there's too much current, then the oxide might break. And of course, and the jump in the current, then will be a corresponding jump in the gate current, which is bad. But as you can see, when this vertical path forms, that's statistically distributed. Average doesn't say anything about it. So that is something we'd like to see, what the consequences are. By the way, if you wanted to map it on the same problem in that other picture I had been showing, the way you should think about it is that every time these defects are being generated, as if it is moving on that scale and the current is zero because there is no percolating path, and then the final straw, the final defects pushes you up the threshold and you jump up. And that's what I have seen or shown on the left side, that you actually, one defects can cause a huge change in the current. and we'd like to know its distribution. So let's do some math. You know, this is undergraduate math, I can assure you. So let's do that. Assume this oxide, and I divide it into m by n piece. Now, m is very small because oxide these days is very thin, right? This is a few nanometers thick. So m is very small, and n is the area. So the n could be very big, 1,000, it could be very big. And we want to ask the question that at what point this would break. Now, the rate at which the defects are generated, we'll call it some t to the power alpha. T is the time. And so some exponent, generally an experimental is half, but you don't have to worry about it. It could be anything. So with time, more and more, this probability of finding a defect is increasing. So that's why the average, that average point is occupied, that's going up in time. So let's see how to do this problem then. If I needed a vertical path continuous, what would you say? If the probability at each point of finding a defect is q, if I need m of them in a continuous line, then it should be q to the power m. And then you can put it in another side. Now, the probability that you do not have any shorted path is 1 minus p, meaning p means vertical path being shorted, multiplied by n, because in none of the n columns, you have a short. So, therefore, the probability of not failing is 1 minus p to the power n. Well, you can write it up and say that this is like an exponential of np, because n is large. So, you could do this simple trick. Now, the probability of failing? Well, probability of failing is 1 minus probability of not failing. And so, you either pass or you fail. And so, you can just subtract. And you can plot out. This is just a way of writing. You take a log, double log, so that you can bring this np up front. And essentially, you can write it out. And so, this would be a bottom-up view of thinking about oxide reliability, because you started from the defects, build them up, and wanted to see at what point they will fail. Now, this says something very important. It says, m, remember, is the oxide thickness. So, it says that the failure time will scale with oxide thickness, and if you make oxide thinner, then it will fail faster. Well, that makes sense. But it also says that it has to go as a log of t, and it has to go with a log of n. So, it makes some very precise statements about how oxides would fail. Then, you go ahead and make some simulations. And what I am plotting here is this y-axis is that w plotted in a log, and this is the failure time, again plotted in a log. And these are for thin oxides. This is thicker and thicker and thicker. And what this is saying, that as the oxide thickness is going up, the slope of failure will change. That makes sense, because if you have a thin oxide, there is a chance that accidentally two will sit on top of each other and cause a short. But if it is thicker, probability that you will accidentally line up five of them is small. So therefore, there is this change in the slope. And from that curve, you can plot out the slope of those lines. And it says that as a function of Tox, the slope of these lines should go linearly. That is what it says. And this you do in experiment, and you will find exactly the same result. Now, this is something you couldn't possibly get in any other way if you don't do the percolation problem correctly. Because many times people say that when the distribution is very poor, things are failing early, maybe if you improve the process, you know, reduce the defects in some way, that it will be able to change this. But it looks like that you cannot. This is a fundamental property of thin oxides, and you cannot do anything about it, and a top-down view wouldn't work. This is important because, unlike a thermodynamic problem where average is of fundamental importance, in electronics, it's the extreme value that is important, because when one transistor fails, it doesn't matter when 50% of the fails. When one transistor fails, the whole thing fails. So it's very important, therefore, to know when one part in a billion, if it's a billion transistor here, one part in a billion transistor would fail. Because then, as soon as that fails, your IC is gone. Now you can see why computer simulation wouldn't work. pure computer simulation would work, because if you do computer simulation, let's say these are few points, so you do 100 or 50, or if you do 50 experiments. But if you do not have it, and you can get an average, and you'll be fine. Average will be fine. But you see, you'll be fundamentally wrong about the distribution. Let's say you try to put a Gaussian or a log normal because you didn't know anything. Somebody told you that, oh, well, this is how to think about it. You fit an arbitrary distribution. The arbitrary distribution will be fundamentally different. And as a result, if you don't do the problem correctly, you will be quantitatively wrong, not qualitatively wrong. And that is a very important point why percolation is important and has to be done right. And that's what I meant by statistical distribution being physical, that every physical process brings with it a statistical distribution. Eventually, everything goes as a Gaussian. It's like eventually all of us are dead and equal, but that doesn't mean when we are alive that everybody is the same. So therefore, the process is important for small systems. These are very important that we treat the problem correctly. I'll end with this in next 5 minutes or so. I'll end with the second problem. And this particular problem is something where even the average is wrong. Even the average, if you don't do the problem correctly, even the average will be wrong. The previous one is statistical deviation is wrong. Now, this problem is stated in the following way. And this is really a prototype for a wide class of problems. I'll explain later. So assume that you have a river. You have a river, one-dimensional river. And then there is a waterfall in the end. And then there's a mountain on the left. And you introduce fish in here. The fish are blind. And so therefore, they hop left and right with the probability half and diffuse around it. And eventually, when they go there, they don't hang up there. They fall down the waterfall. Now, this question is, I'll show that it's a very special problem because this is a stochastic process terminated by a threshold. And this is a model for a wide class of problems. You know, sometimes when I show this problem to my friends, they say, I'm originally from Bangladesh. And people like the staple food, fish and rice very much. Now, I try to assure them that that's not why I chose this fish problem, but I'd like to convince you that that's really the case. So we'd like to explain the arrival time distribution. Now, the arrival time distribution is really a model for a large class of problems. And some of them I'd like to discuss later in the lectures. One is about field return in the components. That when things, when you buy, when let's say Intel introduces a set of ICs in a given year, how long will it take before all their ICs or all their computers come back? Is there a certain time they will have to wait, or will they have to wait for a very long time? How would you think about it? Charge loss in nanocrystal flash, for example. If you have a certain number of fish injected originally, how long, and all in a sudden turn on the waterfall, how long will it be before all the fish are lost? These are the questions you want to ask. These also have consequences for release of protein inside a cell, drug release from capsules. You know, when you take capsules, then with certain time, the drugs are released. And this release process is, again, can be modeled by this. Now, this is not something people talk about in these terms. If you Google it, there's nothing called a distribution of this sort. But I personally find this to be a distribution of wide use, that I can use it for explain a wide variety of phenomena. Okay. So let's say I have just bought a computer, and I simulate that process. And I simulate with 100 fish, meaning 100 points, I put it in. And I wanted to know, so of course, with 100 fish, some of them, you can see, are coming in early, within 1,000 seconds, let's say. Some of them a little later, 10 to the power 5 seconds. I know nothing about distribution because I didn't solve for it. I'm just doing computer simulation. And if I fit it now with log normal because somebody told me so, or somebody just learned gamma for gamma distribution, so they fitted it, and you will get some result. The only problem is that this is fundamentally wrong. The reason is that if you do a little bit more, Monte Carlo, a little bit more, so put more and more fish, see whether you can improve the accuracy. What you'll find very soon that the distribution is not converging to anything. And in fact, you can show that this distribution will never converge. This distribution will keep going down. And this, if you try to do an integration to get an average, you know, this probability distribution. So you multiply with t and try to get an average. This doesn't have any average. So let me quickly tell you how I got that, and then I'll show you why you don't have any average. First of all, we'll assume for the time being that the mountain is on the far left and not interacting. I'll explain that in a second. And you can solve essentially a diffusion problem, you know, time-dependent diffusion problem. And the boundary condition simply says that on the right, the second line of the boundary condition says that on the right you have a waterfall and you are injecting particles at a given point x naught, and you're solving that problem. Well, the solution is something you know. This will be a Gaussian, but since there is this waterfall, there is this, in order to satisfy this boundary condition, you can sort of think that there is another corresponding image point on the other side. And so, two injection points. So, that is the two parts of the Gaussian. Okay, but this is just a math thing. And you know that either the fish either have to be in the river or in the waterfall, right? Either or. And so, you can satisfy that condition by saying that if f tau is the arrival time distribution and px of t is the probability that the fish is within the river, you sum them up. And that must be one. And you know the value of p, so you get a value of f tau and you get a probability distribution. Looks like a Gaussian, but the important thing is that in the denominator, it has a 3/2. And you can see that at long time, the exponential, at a long time, it will go to 0, and it will be exponential of 0 is 1. But you can see in the long term, this will go as 1/3. It will flow as 1/3. And that's where the tail came from. The tail didn't decay. And what that does is, if you assume something else, didn't solve the problem properly. If you assume something else, log normal or, you know, gamma function, then you would expect an average. Because you'll have a certain number of samples, you'll expect an average. But if you do it properly, you'll see that the average never converges. Because when you multiply this with t and 1/3, this will give you a square root of t. And the square root of t, if you wait longer and longer, it will keep going up. So that means that actually this problem doesn't even have the average right. So you have to really do percolation in a proper way. It's only then you get the right results. By the way, this has consequences. As I said, the percolation problems are so nice because in fundamental way it's statistical. And there are, if you Google on this problem of long tail, you'll see there's a lot of talk why Amazon, you know, Amazon.com, why it makes a profit over Walmart. And the fundamental reason is because of this long tail. Because Amazon can sell 2 books to 3 customers. And if you have a million of those book people who just want some specific books, then you can have on the tail, make a big profit on the tail. Although when Walmart makes its model of sale, it really focuses on a Gaussian type distribution. You store things that most people will buy. You're not interested in 2 people buying 1 item. So that makes a fundamentally different model, and that explains, this is a very beautiful book, and explains essentially the same way, the way I explain why when average don't matter, then how to think about the problem correctly. I will quickly explain what happens when you have a mountain or a boundary condition, but I'll not go into the details because that's not the essential point. But because Paolo tell all the way to infinity, that sounds a little fishy. So I want to explain that at what point this doesn't work anymore. You see, the way it worked is that if you have a diffusion of probability half going one way and probability half of going other way, then every time you have a fish in here, half of the fishes decided to say, says, oh, I have come too far, let me go back. But the other half is adventurous, it takes another step. Blind fish randomly does so. So that means that there is a powell or tail coming from when they decide to come back. So this going farther out, and there is always a half race to some power of the extra steps, that gives rise to the powell law. Now what the mountain does, it breaks the symmetry. Because what it does, that when you hit the mountain, you have a probability 1 of going back, probability 0 of coming in. As a result, what will happen, if you sit down here for a long period of time, you will feel as if there is a flow in the river, if you don't see the mountain. Because you'll see slightly more number of fishes going to the right than to the left because of this effect. And as a result, what will happen, the probability will not be half and half. In the presence of that boundary condition, probability will be slightly more going to the right, half plus a, slightly less going to the left. And as a result, the average will not really be infinity, but the average will be actually tau is the hopping time, delta is the spacing, read spacing, x naught is where you injected it. Of course, if you inject it further back, you will take more time. A is the asymmetry, meaning that if the mountain is close, the asymmetry will be large, average will be large. But if the mountain is far away, then A will be close to zero and tau average will go to infinity. So this boundary condition, eventually you will not have to worry about infinity. But again, my point is, if you just did a computer simulation, you wouldn't know any of this. And therefore, all your results would be wrong. So again, wrapping it up, I tried to explain to you that statistical fluctuation or randomness is not something you should think of as an afterthought. This is fundamental and pervasive in electronics, all aspects, microprocessors, displays, solar cells, energies, everywhere. And the model on which we'll work on is this model on the left with some disks or sticks on a checkerboard. And we'll try to understand how that behaves. And if we understand that one, then hopefully we'll understand all the problems on the top, or at least have a beginning attack on all the problems on the top shown here on the right. So percolation theory is necessary, hopefully, but this is what I want to emphasize, that the percolation for an electrical engineer is not the percolation for a physicist for this reason. That's why we need to take a different tech, not a classical tech. You cannot simply go and borrow a few books from the library and all of a sudden start solving this problem. And the reason is this. The first point is that most of the time, people are interested in physics of problems that are big. Because even a drop of water, if you want to know the boiling point of a drop of water, well, 10 to the power 17 number of molecules. So there, you are not talking about 10 molecules or 15 molecules and the statistical fluctuation. So large system and thermodynamic limit is very different from small systems with few number of things. So that is something has to be explicitly accounted for. Now, disk percolation is a central paradigm in physics because everywhere you see percolation problem, disk. Now, as I showed that many cases, we'll have to worry about stick percolation and of various sizes. When you have, and therefore, if you just learn about disk percolation, that's not enough. Third one is, and this is something both Professor Lundstrom and Professor Dutta alluded to, that physics is primarily concerned in many times on linear response. You apply a little voltage, 10 millivolt, 100 millivolt, and see how much current flows. But if you take it to an electrical engineer, let's say at AMD, IBM, or Intel, and say, I have a theory for 10 millivolts, will you, and I want to tell you about something about it, they will say, well, come back next week, which means never. Because you actually want to apply a very large bias on the drain. Transistor operates in the nonlinear regime. And if you don't know how to handle percolation theory in the nonlinear regime, which doesn't exist in the literature today, then you actually have no relevance in terms of most of the problem in electrical engineering. So you'll have to know what happens when you apply a large bias. small bias problem is not enough. Heterogeneous percolation, again, I said, carbon nanotube, you remember, metallic semiconducting, or if you remember the solar cell problem, two interpenetrating organic material. Then, in those cases, heterogeneous percolation is routine in electrical engineering. Almost nothing is said about heterogeneous percolation in the physics books. Now, transport on a plane or a volume, this is something, of course, mostly people confined in, but this type of problem, transport into the from third dimension onto the network, far fewer references or literature is available. But again, you see, that's for sensors and for solar cells, that's a very important problem. So again, that has to be done properly. And finally, we are interested in transient systems because transistors on get on and off. And, you shine the light on and then you want to turn it off. So we are really interested in transient problems. How long does it take before when you send a test for the doctor, it takes a certain amount of time before the test is completed. If it takes 1 day, fine. 2 days, well. If it takes a year, that's not a technology. And as electrical engineers, we are not interested. So steady state is good, but transient is fundamental. And that is something we also need to handle. So hopefully I'll see you in lecture 2, where I'll begin to explain some of these concepts. Okay, thanks.